Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
On today's episode of The Bell Tell, in his new book, Dangerous Escapades, former private investigator Ian Withers talks of some of his more colourful exploits throughout his glistening career.
When they raided my house in Antrim, I was taken to London, spent two enjoyable days at the interrogation centre of the counter-terrorism branch in South London.
From bumping into Jerry Kelly in prison after the Old Billy bombing.
The entire active service unit of the IRA had been arrested at Heathrow Airport, so they all ended up in Brixton in a high security wing. And the most well-known one of those that I dealt with was Jerry Kelly. The other ones which will be well-known were the Price sisters.
Keeping tabs on dissident politicians for the Seychelles government.
There had been threats made to individuals in Seychelles, and an assassin was sent to the island who'll be identified and we're keeping tabs on.
Or even tracking down an alleged IRA bomber.
As it transpired, the Irish couldn't find him, and they never said they didn't try, but just that they couldn't find him. I used the pretext of being from the DHSS, Department of Health and Social Security, Britain's Unemployment Office, and asked if they had a record of John Downey. And within a few minutes, the chap came back to me and said, "Oh, yes, we've got him. He signs on every couple of weeks and he's due to sign on this week." I think the Irish government at that time were quite embarrassed, having been really caught out.
I'm sitting down with the man himself as he tells his story. Ian, welcome to The Bell Tell.
Thank you very much.
So we'll start with your early days. A lot of people have this romantic idea of what a private investigator does, very cloak and dagger kind of stuff. But what is your background? How did you become a private eye?
I kind of fell into it from a family business in the building industry, where as a partnership and very young in early 20s, we had a client that disappeared and didn't pay the bill. Desperate for money, I got sent out on behalf of the partnership to hunt him down, which I did, only to find that he'd gone bankrupt and we didn't get paid. In fact, we ended up buying him lunch. And from there, I decided that hunting him down was much more satisfying than the building industry.
So the thrill of the chase?
Absolutely, the thrill of the chase, and the success was very, very rewarding. Mm-hmm. And so I was fortunate enough to find an advert for a trainee private investigator in London. And I applied and got the job, worked with them for about 2 years, repossessing television sets, as you did in those days, the old motor car and tracing missing debtors. Really exciting stuff. So exciting that I then joined the police for a few years, and then I was headhunted by my old boss and taken back into the company as a general manager.
Okay, and so tell us a wee bit about your first, say, big case. I understand that was the Jeremy Thorpe case, and that involved your first trip to Ireland.
Yes, that was an eye-opener. I got hired through my previous boss to work for Jeremy Thorpe, or work for the Liberal Party, as it was then.
He was a rising star in the Liberal Party at the time.
He was a top star, top draw politician, and many people thought that he would eventually be, potentially could become a prime minister.
But there was a wee snag there in that he had allegedly a secret gay affair.
Well, no longer allegedly. It's a proven fact he did have a secret gay affair going on. And
this was at a time, obviously, when it could have...
It was still illegal. Yeah. It was still illegal. The act hadn't been changed at that time. Mm-hmm. And his lover was frustrated enough to start, in inverted commas, blackmailing him, or certainly making threats, and disappeared to Ireland. So I was engaged to try and hunt him down to enable them to negotiate with him, to which they did eventually, and paid him a weekly salary to not talk to the press.
And how exactly did you go out hunting him down? I mean, if you've never been to Ireland before at this time.
I've never been on the plane at that time.
Where do you even start?
Well, the first thing I did, fortunately enough, I've been given information by the clients, by the Liberal Party, and one of the leads I was given was a priest in Dublin who had knowledge and had advised Norman Scott over the years. And I was able to talk to him when I got to Dublin. And after two or three telephone conversations and the realisation, he realised then that I was not out to get him, rather out to help him. And he actually disclosed where he was, and I was able to drive down to Waterford and find him, although I did meet him but didn't know it was him. I didn't recognise him as such. And he did a runner at that point. But what he then did was to telephone his contact at the Liberal Party to say that somebody was hunting him down. And that evidenced the fact that I had found him. And so the case was resolved, shall we say.
Yes, you got your job done.
Precisely.
Yeah, of course. And I've been reading through your book. It's a great read. And there's obviously, being here at the Belfast Telegraph, we are always looking for, you know, Northern Ireland connections in what we do. And there was a period where you spent a few months in prison on, well, a trumped-up charge, essentially. But while you were there, you met a few IRA members, which many of our readers will be familiar with. Can you tell us a wee bit about that?
Well, indeed. At the time, I was still working in London, but had an office in Belfast. And I had been charged and appeared at the Old Bailey on a conspiracy to obtain information, which is, of course, what we do. Ultimately, that was determined by the House of Lords that there was no such offence known in English law. And after 3 months in Brixton Prison, we were kicked out. Having said that, we could have been out sooner than 3 months, except an IRA active service unit blew up the Old Bailey and in doing so destroyed the transcription room, which meant that our appeal for release couldn't be heard until it was re-prepared.
There's hardly a building within a radius of 250 yards from where the bomb went off that hasn't been damaged.
So, sitting in there shortly after the bombing, feeling very depressed, we learned that the entire active service unit of the IRA had been arrested at Heathrow Airport.
At Ealing Police Station, the seven men and three women from Northern Ireland taken off the Thursday morning plane to Belfast are still being questioned. None have been charged yet, but they're held under Section 2 of the Criminal Law Act, which gives the police wide powers of arrest without a warrant.
They obviously haven't decided that, having bombed London, they could jump on the plane at Heathrow Airport and go home to Belfast, which didn't quite work. So they all ended up in Brixton in a high security wing. And I was at the time in prison, and my job was in the canteen, which was the tuck shop in the jail. And as such, I used to deliver tobacco goods and sweets and bits and pieces to the high security wing, where I interfaced with the active service unit. And the most well-known one of those that I dealt with was Gerry Kelly.
He's now a Sinn Féin politician.
He's now a Sinn Féin politician, yes. He was, I would say, the head man of the little group. The other ones which would be well known were the Price sisters, who were both there. It was in the high security wing, male and female. So the Price sisters were in there. And I think there were five or six others as well whose names I do have, but I can't recall them from my memory.
How did you find them and your interaction with them, what little interactions you did have?
Well, when they came in under military guard into the prison, they were quite aggressive, excited, not terribly cooperative. When they got into the wing, and when we first met them a couple of days later, Gerry Kelly was courteous. He would speak to us, and relatively normal, and a bit as you would expect one prisoner to speak to another. One can't say he was friendly, and certainly I didn't feel particularly friendly towards him, as he was the man that just caused me to have to stay there. The Price sisters were the very opposite. They were very difficult. They would spit on the floor when the prison guards would go near them, the screws, as they're called in jail, would go there. They'd spit on the floor and curse and swear and were, generally speaking, very disruptive. The others were just very quiet and, I think, shocked to be where they were.
Yeah, yeah. Another case that I've actually been writing about after reading your book is the case of John Downey. Now, for those who don't know, John Downey is a man who has been convicted of IRA membership, and he was alleged to have been involved in the 1982 Hyde Park bomb, in which four soldiers died and seven horses had to be put down due to their wounds. Now, he was suspected of involvement in the attack, but he fled the mainland UK in the aftermath, and he was believed to have been hiding in the Republic. How did you become involved in the case of John Downey?
During that period of time, one of our regular clients was the Sunday Times newspaper, the Insight team in particular, and the journalist, or the main journalist, was Barry Penrose, the late Barry Penrose. And it transpired that he had been speaking to Britain's Attorney General, Sir Michael Havers, I think it was, who had a bomb planted at his house in Wimbledon by the IRA a few years previously. And it transpired, of course, that Britain had requested Ireland to locate and identify where Downey was, with a view to extraditing him back to the UK. As it transpired, the Irish couldn't find him, and they never said they didn't try, but just that they couldn't find him. He hadn't been found despite all the resources they had. So the Attorney General decided to ask Barry Penrose, Sunday Times, if he would use his resources in Ireland, and that was us, to see if we could find him as an alternative to the authorities. And as you'll appreciate, at that time, well, at any time, the Brits could not operate in the Republic legally.
Of course, yeah. But you had no such restrictions.
We had no such restrictions. We had an office in Dublin and we worked both sides of the border. So Barry Penrose called me up one day and asked me to meet him, and we went into a fish and chip shop. I think it was on Castlereagh Street or somewhere like that, in East Belfast, had fish and chips, and he posed me with this challenge to see whether I could find, as he described it, Britain's most wanted terrorist.
And it turns out, actually, it was a wee bit easier than you might have imagined.
Incredible. I'm still shocked when I think about it now. That
yes, as we say, you couldn't write this stuff, but you did write this stuff.
And yes, yes, indeed. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so what happened?
So I went back to the office and thought about how I would go about it, thinking of all the options that might be there. And I thought the easiest one to make a start with was to phone the Irish Social Security, PRSI as it was called, and just to check whether he was on their system. So I used the pretext of being from the DHSS, Department of Health and Social Security, Britain's Unemployment Office in Hammersmith, which is a good place for Irish matters. And I telephoned, identified myself, and they accepted my identity. I used a dummy name and asked if they had a record of John Downey's such and such date of birth and the reason that we had an unemployment benefit check to send to him, which he hadn't collected, and we needed an address to post it to. And within a few minutes, a chap came back to me and said, "Oh, yes, we've got him." He gave me an address in Donegal for his record, and he said, "Oh, by the way, he's on unemployment over here, and he signs on every couple of weeks, and he's due to sign on this week in Ballyshannon office. If you want to send it there, you can probably pick it up."
So you knew exactly where he was going to be in 2 days' time.
Exactly. So that was exciting enough. I had to contain myself. So I then telephoned my client, Barry Penrose, at the Sunday Times, gave him that information, and I think he fell off his seat. Couldn't quite believe it. The Irish government not having been able to find him for whatever it was, a year or two. And he said, "Can I get somebody down there and get a photograph of him?" So we had different sub-agents, subcontractors that we had in Ireland, and I picked one that happened to be in Dundalk. He did a quick run on the Friday morning or Thursday morning, whichever day it was, and sat outside there all day. And eventually
using the telephoto lens, we got a number of photographs of John Downey coming out of the unemployment benefits office. He rushed the film back to Dundalk. I drove down, collected it, and the Sunday Times sent a runner over from London. In those days, you had the Belfast shuttle just to jump on and jump off. Mm-hmm. And they collected the film, and on the Sunday, it came out a front page story. I can't remember the wording, something along the lines, Britain's most wanted terrorist draws his dole in Ireland.
Of course. And that case actually had quite significant ramifications in terms of cooperation between the Irish and the British at this time.
Well, after the case, after the newspaper published, the House of Commons went into uproar, and complaints were made to the Irish authorities. And this actually seemed to rush along the negotiations that had been going on, which ultimately became, a few months later, the Anglo-Irish Agreement.
Of course, I think
the Irish government at that time were quite embarrassed, having been really caught out.
Yeah, of course, of course, of course.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Prime Minister and the Taoiseach will sign the Anglo-Irish Agreement 1985. They will then retire. The documents will then be issued to you.
So we move on to another interesting chapter in your story, and it's just, people might find this quite strange, but it involves the Seychelles. Obviously, it's now seen as a kind of tourism hotspot, but in the late 70s and 80s, it was a very different kind of place. A lot of political upheavals, fair to say, at that time.
Well, it always was a holiday hotspot. It was the honeymooners' first choice. Mm-hmm. And it had been a British colony for many years, having argued between the French and the English for a century. Mm-hmm. It became a British colony, and in 1974, my memory is being tested now, but 1974, independence was granted, and the first election got a president by the name of James Mankham, who became Sir James Mankham. He was a bit of a playboy, and allegedly he negotiated with various rich people to sell off licenses to the main beaches for casinos and a Las Vegas-style operation.
Yeah, and then in, I think it was 1977, the socialist...
77, his opposition man, who, if you like, was the Labour Party of the Seychelles, mounted a coup. It was technically a bloodless coup, although there was one police officer killed, mm-hmm. so it wasn't bloodless in the real sense.
Yeah, and that man was Albert René.
Albert René, who was the president of Seychelles then, well, really until he retired, and he retained power even when they bought democracy back in the 90s. He still retained power for another 15 years.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And then how did you become hired by this government of René's?
Well, in shortly after the coup and President René having got control, there was an attempted coup mounted by the French government, sending a French gunboat. Mm-hmm. And this made them very sensitive. This was discovered. And ultimately, they decided they needed security. So as with a lot of Commonwealth countries, they requested the British government to provide shared intelligence, as the opposition were all living in London. So Britain declined to provide shared intelligence because it was a single-party, left-wing, allegedly Marxist state. Mm-hmm. But they did provide them with a list of commercial agencies, of which we were on that list.
Oh, I see. And obviously there was, there was a lot of opposition, kind of dissident politicians, which you were asked to keep tabs on.
Precisely.
And one of those was, if we'll bring us back to the start, was Gerard Poirot.
Yes.
Can you tell us a wee bit about him and your interactions with him? Because you kept quite a close tabs on him.
Over a number of years.
And
yes.
It became a wee bit of a game almost.
Yes, one would say it's almost lighthearted in a serious sense.
Yeah.
Gerard Poirot was very motivated. He was young. He had high office in Seychelles. He'd been a minister in the previous Mankham government. He was a star of the local football team, well-educated, and spoke a number of languages. And in fact, he was a very pleasant guy, but exceedingly motivated. And his one plan was to usurp the René government and reinstall James Mankham.
And then we have the case in 1985 and the fate that befell Gerard Poirot when he was living in London.
Indeed, yes. In November of 1985, Gerard Poirot was machine gunned in London outside his home and killed. Mm-hmm. I was in socials at the time.
And Rene was suspected of involvement in the media and whatnot?
Well, only by the police. And there was some media intimated it, but never ever said that directly.
Yeah.
But the police transpired that they believed that he was involved.
Good evening. The president of the Seychelles, Mr. Albert Rene, was accused tonight of being behind the murder of a political opponent in London today. Mr. Gerard Poirot, who was said to have organized an unsuccessful coup in the Seychelles 3 years ago, was shot dead in broad daylight at his home in Edgware. The former president of the Seychelles, Sir James Mankham, who was overthrown by Mr. Rene, claimed it was a political assassination. Seychelles government representatives in London denied any blame.
And what was the reaction like in the Seychelles at the time?
In Seychelles, very little reaction. I mean, we anticipated. I got called to a meeting literally the same day, the afternoon that the murder took place, mm-hmm. In anticipation of there being riots in the streets. But there were no effects at all, mm-hmm. really. Very little happened in Seychelles.
And then what happened with that case in terms of how it impacted your life then?
Well, I'd been publicised previously as working for Seychelles. It was a known fact in the media and by the police and, of course, by the Foreign Office, because I was reporting to the Foreign Office. I was liaising, shall we say, between the Rene government and the Foreign Office, the Foreign and Colonial Office. So they all knew that I was working there. So the police put two and two together and made three, decided I was number one suspect. I wasn't in England at the time, so they knew it wasn't me. But they then raided my office in Brighton, my office in Belfast, and my home in Dunardry.
They arrested County Antrim,
in County Antrim. They arrested my staff. Young girls in Brighton were taken in for 6 days to the anti-terrorist branch in Paddington Green, and kept. They had nothing to say. They knew nothing, and mm-hmm. ultimately released. The staff in Northern Ireland were arrested and interviewed. They weren't kept overnight. They were released the same day. And my lawyers in Brighton, my solicitor, contacted the police to let them know where I was and to offer assistance. They decided they didn't want me, and they actually put it in writing in telexes that they did not wish to see me. They had no interest in seeing me. The Seychelles government, through the Foreign Office, offered the police free trips on the Air Seychelles aircraft to Seychelles to interview me and to any other staff that were there and to look at any recordings or photographs that had been taken during the time that we'd been observing.
And why do you think they didn't avail of that opportunity? If you said that all the trouble of, you know, arresting your staff and whatnot, you'd think if you're being offered on a plate.
Yes, it's something which is frankly beyond my understanding, how they would have not taken the opportunity if they felt that that was the case. And then ultimately, 30-odd years later, to make an arrest. Seems
exactly,
ridiculous.
Yeah. So if we fast forward then to the 30 years later in that morning in August 2018, by this stage, obviously, the murder was still unsolved. We know that much. Why wait 30 years, or what happened? What was the event that kind of triggered that?
What I believe triggered it was the change of government in Seychelles.
Okay.
And a new government that were the opposition, in effect, came back into power.
So they wanted to find who killed their man?
But they wanted to try and pin it, I think, on the old president.
I see.
And his merry band, of which they considered me to be one of those.
I see. So they would have put a wee bit of pressure, or maybe just a request to the...
I think that's what it was,
to the Met police to then arrest you. But was there any sort of, because at the time you were tapping, was it the phones of Poirot?
Yes.
At the time it was murder, yeah.
Yes. No, I wasn't tapping the phones. What had happened is that in the last year, 1985, there had been threats made to individuals in Seychelles, and an assassin was sent to the island who we identified and were keeping tabs on. And because of that, two of my team were in Seychelles doing bodyguard for one minister and one high-profile individual. And that's why we were in Seychelles, so we couldn't deal with anything else. So when they wanted to have the telephones tapped of Poirot,
I arranged for another contractor who provided that kind of service to take on the work.
I see.
And that was a separate contract to my contract.
Okay. I see. And then you were flown over to London to be questioned for a couple of days, was it?
Yes. When I was when they raided my house in Antrim, I was taken to London, spent two enjoyable days at the interrogation centre of the counter-terrorism branch, SO15, in South London.
And was there a stage where you got the feeling, well, did the police realise you had nothing to do with it? Or?
Well, I think I got to that stage really by halfway through day one.
Mm-hmm.
And it became obvious when they disclosed to me what they had got. And it seemed nothing linked to me.
Mm-hmm.
So I was fully cooperative.
There was also a strange link to the CIA in this case.
Well, this was the beginning of my thinking that they had other lines of inquiry that were open to them. One of the questions they asked me is whether I'd ever been in the house that had been used for the recordings in London.
For the bug recordings?
For the bug recordings. Yeah. I bought the house. I bought the house on behalf of the Seychelles government using a company which I owned in Jersey.
I see.
Now, I would hardly buy a property in my own name if I was going to arrange to assassinate someone.
Yes.
But anyway, that doesn't count. So it transpired they found a fingerprint. They hadn't found any of my fingerprints in there, although I'd been in the house on two occasions, one when I inspected it before I bought it, and secondly, when the keys were given to me.
Mm-hmm.
Then the keys were handed then to the contractor that was doing the electronics.
Mm-hmm.
I've never been in the house since.
Mm-hmm.
So they found this one print which wasn't identified. They ultimately got an ID from the States, and it transpired to be a CIA operative who was a specialist in unarmed combat and assassination, mm-hmm. I think what the official word was.
And what would the CIA's interest in the Seychelles be?
It can become quite a complicated story, but mm-hmm. the United States had a space tracking system at that time on Seychelles.
I see.
Which at that time was vital to the space program because it was one of the only ones in the world that could see both sides of the equator.
I see.
Seychelles was 4 degrees south of the equator, and therefore the space tracking station could see both sides.
Mm-hmm.
And we're now in the period of time from the 1970s or 1960s onwards, where they were just going into the shuttle program, mm-hmm. the early part of it. So by the 80s, the shuttle program was well advanced, and that space station, satellite tracking station, was vitally important. There had been attempts by the Russians, allegedly, to damage it, to destroy it, and Seychelles was purported to be a Marxist state, i.e. communist state, which it wasn't, but the politicians thought it was. And the Americans' interest would have been to maintain stability, to maintain their tracking station.
Of course. And so with the Waro case and your arrest, it still wasn't really, once you were released after the 2 days, you were released with a certain kind of strange condition in terms of still not being completely cleared.
Well, it's an odd one. It's mm-hmm. They used to bail you and you had conditions of bail, but then this all changed and they have a new terminology, which is called released under investigation, which means to say that you have no ties, no obligations. You don't have to turn up and to prove that you're still in the country. I was completely free, but I carry for this last 5 years now this term of being under investigation.
It's still in place to this day?
It's still in place to this day. Yeah. I have actually made an application through my MP now to have this examined, perhaps by the Minister of Justice.
I see. So now, after decades of globetrotting and near misses, and what is life like for a former PI?
Well, it's quite relaxing these days.
So you're semi-retired, you're not retired?
Well, you never semi-retire. You never retire. You semi-retire.
Semi-retire.
Or as I say, semi-demi-retire.
Ian Withers, thank you for joining us on The Bell Tale.
My pleasure.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.